Hey, thanks for tuning in again to Let's Talk Addiction, a BIPOC perspective. We want to make you aware of our new email. If you need to contact us, you want to send some feedback on the program, you can get in contact with us at letstalkaddiction911@gmail.com. That's letstalkaddiction911@gmail.com. Send us questions that you'd like to hear us discuss online. We'd be happy to include them in a future episode of the podcast. I'm Dr. Alfonso Brown, and now let's get into this week's episode of Let's Talk Addiction, a BIPOC perspective. Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Alfonso Brown, and welcome to Let's Talk Addiction, a BIPOC perspective. Last week, we had the unfortunate challenge of reviewing a recent startling article which showed that for the first time ever, members of the African American community and also the Native American community had the highest rates of drug overdose deaths of any racial group in the United States. This information was startling because it had never happened before, but even more perplexing was the reason why. With our usual savvy, we attempted to provide an evidence-based review of the potential causes, as well as look at some additional explanations. This week, we're going to focus on how we as members of the BIPOC community can come together try to prevent this problem from happening again. We'll also analyze whether or not other factors such as misclassification of diagnoses and lack of resources could be to blame. You won't want to miss this discussion. As usual, I'll be joined by my spirited guests, and we plan to have a very focused, fun, and in-depth review of the subject at hand. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Let's Talk Addiction, a BIPOC perspective. This is Dr. Alfonso Brown. Peace. I wanted to welcome everybody back to Let's Talk About Addiction, a BIPOC perspective, and this is episode 3. And I'm Dr. Alfonso Brown, and I have my two distinguished guests in the audience panel today, and I'd like for them to introduce themselves. Thank you. Let's start with you, Sister Leo.
Go ahead. Melinda.
I was going to let my colleague go. My name is Sister Melinda Pellerin. I'm a sister of St. Joseph in Springfield, Massachusetts. And I completed recently the BACE program.
Okay. And Leal, please.
Hi, good evening. I'm Leal. I am also a recent graduate from the BACE program. I have been working in the field of addiction services probably 25 years or so, off and on. I am also a person with lived experience in it. Thank you for having me, Dr. Alfonso.
Thank you for being here, Leal and Sister Melinda. And thank you.
Last week, we were talking about the recent study that showed for the first time ever, there was a significant increase in the number of African-Americans who died of drug overdoses in the United States. And this is a startling statistic, or at least for me. I think some of my colleagues might disagree, because this was the first time this had been reported on a large scale. And we were interested in trying to figure out why this occurs. And also, this week, we're going to talk about some solutions. The other thing, if we have some time, is we wanted to talk about what happens when major players, such as a lot of you are familiar with Michael Jackson and Prince, who recently died of associated drug overdoses as well. And we'd like to touch upon that a little bit at the end. It looks like our colleague Rob Coleman has joined us as well. Rob, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? Colin, I'm sorry. And you can go ahead and introduce yourself, Rob.
Hello, group. Let's Talk Addiction. I'm Robert Connolly. I'm a public servant. I work for Volunteers of America, and I work for Boston Healthcare for the Homeless. I'm joining in with my colleagues today to speak on the topic that we're talking about.
So I want to again thank everybody for being here. And we're just going to start, the reason why this is such a significant problem is because I don't know about everyone's experience, but in my experience, you don't really see a lot of people from the BIPOC community who die of overdose. This is usually reported as a middle America problem and a rural America problem. And when they talk about a middle America problem, it's usually more of a middle American Caucasian problem and not necessarily BIPOC community problem. So if that's been everyone's experience, why does everyone think that's the case? And again, let's remember everyone to mute your mics if you're not speaking so that we reduce any echo. All right.
Dr. Alfonso, that hasn't been my experience. I said, I'm a person with lived experience. You know, and I don't know whether this is a myth or whether it's something that, you know, we say in the BIPOC community, but you know how they say that, you know, murders don't take place in the suburbs or robberies don't take place in the suburbs. And then someone of African American culture will go, oh, yes, it does. It's just not as televised. That's how I feel about the overdose situation. We've been overdosing and dying for years as a result of illicit drug use. It's just not as televised. I remember, and Dr. Alfonso, you might know a little bit about this. I have a brother that passed away in, I think it was 86, from AIDS related complications, right? And prior to the 80s, according to some studies that I've read, people have been dying from AIDS for years before that, and they was writing it off as natural causes because they had no idea what it actually was. And so I think the same thing is repeating itself. People of color, Native Americans, have been dying for years from overdoses. It's just not as televised.
Would anyone else like to comment on that?
Cyclical. So as a historian, you look at events in history and they keep coming around. I can remember in the late 70s, early 80s, when we were talking about the war on drugs, when Nixon comes into office and this becomes the strategy for local, state, and the federal government, it was all over the news. I'm sure there were statistics about it, but all they did was concentrate themselves on the BIPOC communities, especially the African American community. And, you know, I can remember on 48 Hours, it was as if the only people that were involved with this new crack epidemic were people that looked like us in our neighborhoods. It was nowhere else. And then as more white Americans started dying of it, it becomes front page news. So I think that it's cyclical. So there are moments when you hear a lot about drugs and BIPOC community members dying of it. And then when it's not a news story anymore, they move on to something else. But I would agree that it's always been here. It's just how it's been covered in the United States. If it's newsworthy, then it's covered. If it affects the white population, then it's really covered. And then it just seems to die off. I don't know that. I read the most recent article, and that's what I see as my perspective. It's always been there. It's always been a problem. It's just how this society has been willing to talk about it and or deal with it.
So. Robert Conley, would you like to comment, Rob?
Yes, I find it interesting from both perspectives of Sister Melinda and Sister Layout. I look at it from the point that with media now being your phone, and you can highlight it, and you have people that look like them that's out there mixing with people that look like us doing it, that is getting reported more because they're saying, hey, that's my aunt. That could be my niece. That could be my sister. That's my brother. So it's getting reported, and when it gets reported like that, now we get reported in that, the BIPOC community. So where we was getting overlooked before, these numbers, and them numbers always been there, or the problem has always been there, but now with social media and everybody has access to media if they have a cell phone, it highlights the problem and statistics come out. And now we're seeing the statistics, that the real statistics about the BIPOC community based on information and video and seeing it. Before, you wouldn't see it. It would be reported. It was a black problem. It wasn't in no other community. But now somebody can see it in a suburb, take a picture of it, put it on YouTube, and you say, oh, Newton has a problem. Wellesley has a problem. It's not only in Roxbury, Dorchester. It's not reported in them areas as rapidly as reported in Roxbury, Dorchester, or the urban city, as it is in them affluent communities, because they suppress a lot of that. And sometimes they are the people that work in the news and be able to suppress it. So I think it's always been a problem, like my colleague says. I just think the new exposure of information and videoing and the movement of take the instant gratification of 2 minutes of fame. So if somebody's in Wellesley and they see somebody smoking crack or somebody shooting, somebody may take a picture of that and upload it somewhere, and it gets documented. And then it's not only a BIPOC problem, it's other people's problem. And then they do the numbers. And when they do the numbers, they find out, wow, it's really hit the BIPOC community really hard. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank each of you for your comments. And I just want to ask, based on collectively what you've said, if the case is that this is more of an underreporting issue, would you say that's what we're saying, that the problem has been there, but it has not been reported? I want to ask then, why report it now? What was the reason for the release of this study that shows this dramatic increase? What would be the benefit? Why do you think it was necessary for this information to be disclosed? And you can tie in local events. You know, we talked about last week the issues at Melania Cass Boulevard and Massachusetts Avenue in the greater Boston area. The issue again becomes, you know, what exactly is the reason for this release of the information now, according to what you guys said?
Okay, I don't have any facts to substantiate what I'm about to say, but this is just my opinion. I think that as a result of recent events where we keep getting gunned down by police, by communities, more awareness, Black Lives Matter, right, is now a huge thing. And I think more attention is being brought to the African-American community as a result of recent events. Because I'm telling you, I've been in recovery 30 years. In November, it will be 31 years. Mass and Cass is not new. I lived on Mass and Cass. The only difference then and now is the population of people have changed dramatically from that of just being Black and Hispanic to being predominantly white. We have young African-American children being gunned down with their hands up by police. And so now you have these advocacies, advocacy programs and these different organizations stepping up, saying, nah, this stuff just continues to keep happening in our communities, and it's time to stop. And so we, because we're bringing light, more light to the African-American community, I don't think it's possible for them not to include anything that could be affecting our communities. The disparities, the healthcare disparities, you know, the racial indifferences. I don't think that you can not address anything and everything at this point that could and has affected BIPOC communities.
Sister Melinda?
I think the statistics would point to the fact that, as Lyell says, if you read any scholarly magazines on what's happening and what has been happening in this country, that the Black Lives Matter movement, the relationship between police officers and African-Americans and the BIPOC community, it's nothing new, but because of media, social media, and a new awareness of this, it's cyclical. Like I said, again, it's just coming up again. It's not new. It's just now this is where we are. And I think COVID and all of that, I think, is interrelated into as to what is happening now. But I wish that we as a nation could move from why this is happening and how horrible it is to really doing something about it. Let's stop talking about it. And what are some ways in which we can do something about this problem? And I think the article that we were sent, there's an intersection between drugs and race. And I mean, the article goes on to give effective ways in which we can start to do something about the problem. I think we need to, and these are just my opinions. We often talk about, you know, the COVID, and we jumped on COVID to try to find ways to cure it, to find some kind of an effective medicine to so that people would stop dying. I think we have to treat this in the same way. This is a battlefield, and we have to start to triage in our own communities. And so I don't know. I think it's been here because of the social media, people having cell phones and being able to take a video of a young man who puts his hands up and the police still shoot him, which caused the whole Black Lives Matter movement to begin. We're now, this is the cyclical period that we're in.
And excellent points, Sister Melinda, outstanding points. And hopefully we're going to be able to have some discussion about solutions. Because that's what needs to happen, really. One little thing I'd like to throw out there for your respective communities: how many liquor stores do you find are in the communities? And you know, why is this? And the reason why I ask this is because I seem to notice that some other things that we probably don't associate with, you know, drug addiction, but definitely contribute to the issue are fairly readily available. And one is the presence of liquor stores in a lot of urban and inner city communities, and also products that are sold in those liquor stores that appeal to kids and adults as well. You've got wine coolers and all those things. They start early. Yeah, Rob, you go ahead. And then Sister Melinda.
I would like just go back to the last topic, and I'll let Sister Melinda and Lael, my colleagues, go forward with this before I say anything. I think because it's being highlighted, you can raise money by putting out there that the rate of overdose in the Black community has went up exponentially, 40% in this category, 30% in this category, and the funding will come. It's easier to get the funding if you attach the Black community or the BIPOC community. So I think that is also a ploy and a motive to actually put the numbers out. And I think with my two colleagues, it's driven by Black Lives Matter, and it is driven by the cyclical of the country where it's going. But the funding always come when you use the urban community and you attach the BIPOC community to it. You know what I'm saying? The fund would come. The outcry comes when you have the interracial community or the European community that's being highlighted with the Black community. So like Lael said, this been going on 20 years ago, but the gentrification of the people in the area has changed. And so it's being highlighted. Okay. So we're going to get the money because we're going to put the African-American in the BIPOC community. Numbers went up so high, but in actuality, if you do the demographics in America and just in Massachusetts, it's more people that don't look like us that's on certain kinds of substance than us. It's just we're in a concentrated area, and it gets really readily highlighted of just its BIPOC community, and you kind of miss them. And we're going to get the funding for that community by using these numbers, but are they going to benefit from it? They don't. Our BIPOC community don't really benefit because we don't have the information, and they give their people the information, and they're benefiting from the funding that was allocated for us. And that's my take.
Brother, Sister Melinda, I'm going to let you speak, but Brother Rob, one point I want to add to that. What do you think about the proximity? I once had a patient say to me that Mass and Cass represents a vacation for them. And the reason why is because there's a hospital there, there's a shelter there, there's a jail there, and there's also the ability to have open-air drug use. So why would, with the readily available treatment in that area, you still have this sort of problem that exists at that level? I'll stop there. I'll let Sister Melinda talk, but if you can, or any of the other panelists, you guys can address that before you.
So I often talk about this, but I worshiped on the south side of Chicago, Catholic Church, run by a white priest who had been at that Catholic Church for 40 years. He's very controversial. That's why I love going to Mass there. And one of the things that he was dedicated to doing was on every street corner on the south side of Chicago, what is the most prevalent store that you see? It was a liquor store. Liquor and cigarettes and drugs. The advertisements all over that area, liquor, cigarettes, and drugs. And so I think that, and I like what he used to do. He used to, at every homily, that's when the priest gets up and speaks about the gospel, he related the gospel message to the liquor stores, the cigarettes, and the drugs, and said, we don't have to have those to be the only stores in this neighborhood, but we have to start with changing ourselves. And I think from the article, and I would say it's called The Intersection Between Drugs and Race is Education. Because our own people don't know about generational trauma. They know that anger is maybe an issue in their family, and substance abuse may be an issue in their family, but it's going to have to be, and I said it before, we have to triage our own people And we have to begin to educate our own. And this is a white priest who lives in that neighborhood. He's adopted two African-American young men. But we have to be dedicated to triaging in our own neighborhoods. We have to listen to the people that live there that have to deal with this every day. And triage means you go into the battlefield, and drug substance abuse is the battlefield. And you go in, and doctors who triage go in and you look at the case and you deal with that case right at that point. So how serious are we about effective measures in helping triaging our own neighborhoods by looking at the lines of, you know, there are two lines. I'm going to write a paper on this, but I think there are two lines. There's an intersection between drugs and race. And when you look at two lines, whether they're vertical or horizontal, there's a vertex in the middle of it where the two lines start. And I think it starts with trauma, generational trauma. So people may not agree with me, but I think that's what we have to work on. Just like Father Michael Flager in that neighborhood, what's the source of the problem in the neighborhood? Let's go to the source and make changes in there. And I mean, every week they were going to protest all of these liquor stores in the neighborhood that had become the local bank for a lot of the people that live there. They didn't go to a bank and put their money into a bank account. They went to check cashing places in the liquor store, which, you know, he educated them and brought people in to say that this is not a good idea. This is not what you should be doing to invest in our neighborhood. One of the first things we need to do is get these people out of our neighborhood and bring in significant sources that are going to help us. So that's how you triage a neighborhood. You get to the source. But I think you also need to sit down and talk to the people who live there. Don't act like you know or you have all the solutions. And that's one of the other things that he did. He sat with the people that live, I mean, he lives in that neighborhood too, but he sat with people who did not look like him and got an education about what they need. So I think triage starts there.
So, you know, I just want to answer the question too, why, and this is just, again, my opinion, why there is a liquor store on every corner in an African-American community. First, we have to remember not to forget that slavery created a divide between the houses, right? Slavery conveniently created a divide where most families are single parents. Right. The fathers, most fathers are out of the house. Right. We have circumstances that have put Black communities in positions that they're in. And so you have a single parent household, a mother that might have 1 to 4 children in a household. Right. She's the only breadwinner. She's the only one bringing in money. She's working, right? She got latchkey babies. She don't have time to go to the community meetings. Right? Because that's where decisions are being made. A lot of times in our communities, at those community meetings. And if we're not there to represent what goes on in our communities, then anything's subject to be able to allow to be coming in. Remember not to forget, there's not a Black person that I know that owns any one of these liquor stores in my community or those variety stores. They're not Black people that own those liquor stores. And so it's hard to make a decision on whether or not you're going to put food on your table and pay your rent or show up in your community to make a decision on whether or not a liquor store can come in or another a variety store can come in. And so a divide was created a long time ago. And so it would be really nice if we could all be sitting at the table And I only know this because when I lived in Mattapan, I had the luxury of going to the community meetings. And at those community meetings, the community gets to decide what happens in their community. They want to put something in and bring something in, and the community can, oh, no, 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 no. We're not having that for this, that, and the other reason. So it would be really nice if most of the people, the parents in our communities, had the luxury of going to sit at those meetings, but most times they don't. They're either working one to two jobs to make sure that they can pay their rent, because we know that rent in Boston, Massachusetts is ridiculous, feed their children, put clothes on their children, because here's the other thing. You can't put just anything on your child and send them to Boston Public School, because that's a whole nother issue. Because then your child's getting bullied and beat up, and you got to take time off of work to go to the school. And so decisions are being made, and they're hard decisions for most parents in our communities. They're not making the decisions as to what's happening in their communities because they're not at the table. They're not at the table because they're making the hard decisions about what's their priority. And most time, their priority is their babies and their rent and putting food on the table and all that other stuff that comes along that you scrip and you save and you scuffle to get so that you can have a somewhat normal household.
Yeah. Right.
I would like to add, charity starts at home and it spreads abroad. And like Sister Melinda said, the community within have to bring about change and go out in the community and do the work. I like to add to Lael's point, it's true, and it was said by Elizabeth Warren. She said, if you don't get a seat at the table, you might be what's on the menu. And I think that's what you talked about in what you were saying, because I listened to both of y'all intently. And it has to start within and spread abroad. And we make the effective changes. And even if we, the mothers that can't make it, and the fathers that's not there, the children that's of age, we need to start schooling them and sending them to the meetings. So the ones that's 18, the ones that's in college, the ones that, you know, create Zoom meetings for the community where it's accessible for people that has to work or people that elderly people that can't get there. With this technology, when they have community meetings, they can be affordable by Zoom, but also elderly people may not know how to get on Zoom. So it can be a dual meeting where you have in person and you have Zoom, and that will bring about effective change. I think, and it would be more conducive to what's brought in and what's not brought in. A lot of, we talk about the liquor stores, but we don't talk about the big lottery machines that's in every store or every corner store or every bodega, every barber shop. We don't talk about that. That's another addiction. Yes. Let the moderator take over.
No, I said, what sort of machines did you say we don't talk about? I didn't hear that.
The lottery machines. The lottery machine. So we talk about the liquor stores, but the lottery, you know, people is down on their luck. They're looking for hope. And we know most of the times you're not going to win. You know what I mean? I have somebody that I know that plays $100 every day or every other day. I tell them, just give me the $100 and I give you $20 back. And you're hit every day. You're hit every day for $20. You give me the $100. And I'm going to give you $20 back, and you're going to hit every day. And you have a better winning percentage than you actually going in there to play the lottery. And that's my take.
Sister Melinda, you have the floor, please.
I think
please.
That, you know, Lyell is right. You have to look at the community. One of the things, and they just did it last Sunday at St. Sabina in Chicago. They wanted to bring people in to talk about the liquor stores and how we could make change. But he also had a job fair going on. So you can bring your children and you can go, we're going to talk about the liquor stores, but we're going to also have a job fair. Amazon came in, a number of people. Not only did they do that, we're going to give sneakers out to children and book bags for them to go to school. And not the really good sneakers, the sneakers that, and agencies in and around the South Side came in, Nike came in, and they brought, then they had, which I thought was really cool, local black barbershops came in and said, if your son or daughter, if she wants to come and get their hair done. So they had like this fair going on, you know, all over the place. We did the same thing. I'm part of a social activist organization in Springfield called the Pioneer Valley Project. We wanted to get most of the members that are part of Pioneer Valley are women with children, older, younger grandmothers who take care of their children. We wanted to talk about voter registration. I mean, it can be a very dry topic because a lot of in our community don't see the reason why they need to vote. So we were going to have a session. We made it into a teenage art activity. So we had art stations for middle school and teens. Just if you want to come in and drop off your middle schooler or teen, they can go to stations and paint. If you'd like to stay, we'd like to talk to you about voter registration. I did not think, I said, you know what, this is probably, we're not going to get a lot of teens. Well, it started at 4 and went till 9:30. Most of the group came after 7:30. Grandmothers, mothers, teens came in, and while they were working on activities, we talked to the grandmothers that were taking care of their grandchildren and the mothers who were going off to work for their second shift before they went off to work came and listened. So you got to make it affordable. You have to make it a point where people can attend. And it was really successful. So in Father Flager's case, it's not just talking about liquor stores. But we're going to also have a job fair. And young mothers, if you need sneakers, that they're going to be there. And haircuts, and we're going to do this. So I think that's triage. That's looking. Let's look at the situation and yeah. How can we find ways to get people where they are and to change our communities.
Sister Melinda, that's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. I absolutely love that. And let me just say this, right? A couple of weeks ago, there's an organization in Boston. It's a nonprofit. It was started by some young women that are actually in recovery that lost their child to violence in the streets, right? And they had a similar event where they had food and they had face painting and they had arts and crafts and they had some local barbers out there cutting the kids' hair for school and they had backpacks and supplies. But you know what else we had? We had a bunch of politicians that had absolutely nothing in hand and in tow soliciting votes. And for me, that was sad because one, they gave, and I'm not trying to be funny, and I appreciate, I don't have school age children. My baby's in college. I have school age grandchildren. Fortunate for them, they live in Cambridge. And Cambridge is an island all of its own. They take care of their own. Okay, they nothing they need for nothing in Cambridge. I felt bad at the quality of backpacks that were being given out when there were multiples of politicians soliciting votes. The backpacks that they gave the children, once they put their books in it, are going to break off the backs onto the ground. That was the first thing I noticed. The other thing that I noticed was that there was a bunch of our people soliciting votes from the community, but you all came empty-handed. And so if they're interested, and I'm verbal, y'all know that. Y'all know I have a big mouth. So I do the grill thing because everybody wants to talk about what their platform is. Oh, mine is housing and mine is addiction and mine is this and that. But it begins here with our babies, right? You can change a whole generation if you start with our babies. That you're here soliciting votes from their parents, but not one of you came out to say, what can we do for you? But what can you do for us? So it was pretty disheartening. It was nice to see the arts and crafts and the hot dogs and the hamburgers and the haircuts was, I loved it. But when I looked at the quality of backpacks they were handing out, they were, you know how they handed out them paper backpacks that you put one or two books in and then it's trash? And then nothing else. Boston police showed up. Boston police showed up with an ice cream truck and ran out of ice cream. You don't gain hope like that. And again, it begins with our babies. So you could change a whole generation of people. That was an opportunity. But instead, our powers to be, our politicians were more interested in what they could get out of the event than what they could give to the event.
All right, Lael, I want to thank you. And, you know, I want to say that this has been a pretty passionate discussion on outstanding points. So we're going to wrap up now, but I wanted to first ask some questions and try, as we wind down now, to address some issues. Lael, one of the things that you've brought up both this week and in last week's discussion is the fact that there's a lot of political activity with interest that doesn't seem to translate into structured and real programs. And you sort of sit, you know, with your experience at the interface between these two. So have you thought about ways in which that those interactions, if you will, can translate into longstanding programs? And I'll just throw this out to the group, you know, at Mass and Cass, a few months ago, Brother Connolly, you had pointed out that, you know, the area was cleaned up. And then it's now, as you predicted last week on the news, that it's back to almost to square one again. And this is not for lack of effort. You know, the programs were set up to address this, but we see that this is an issue. And if you were in charge of the situation there, what would you do to change that? What do you think needs to be done? Sister Melinda, who I think is off now, had mentioned earlier about a program within her facility. In the article we sent out, there are a number of different ways involving local agencies and things like that that can get involved. And what do you think, first on our local perspective, needs to be done to try to address these situations in a better capacity? And also, if you could implement these things, how would you do it? And we're going to probably wrap up with the answer to that. So, Brother Rob, I think you have the floor.
Okay. I think you need structural, organizational, community partnership with various agencies to make real changes. Agencies like the hospitals, agencies like institutions of Harvard, MIT, agencies not only housing, agencies far as treatment. I think it needs to be a wraparound service, whereas you actually just don't take a person off the street, put them in a program, don't give them no structure, and then give them a voucher certificate without monitoring, and then that person overdoses in their house because they don't have that person to check on them every hour, every 15 minutes. So I think real change have to start from a partnership where we see each person through to they're able to walk on their own. So I think it's gruesome. It's hard work, but it has to be a real togetherness or partnership with a think tank that they can be swift and changeable and change on the fly without getting legislation, without getting approval from people that's hesitant to move, that don't know the situation, because the situation is fluid down there. And you have to be able to have somebody make decisions that's fluid for the betterment of the people. So community involvement, hospital agency involvement, police involvement, institution involvement. So when you have public safety just not there monitoring the open air drug market, but actually doing something, you know the players, lock them up. You know the people that's high risk. Get them to safety and get them to start recovery. So I believe if it's trauma is the part of the epidemic, trauma-informed information. We have the needle exchange. We have the sweetheart kits where we give the girls a straight shooter, we give them a meth pipe, and we give them condoms, we give them chapstick, we give them sanitizer and stuff like that. But they just come ask for it. Let's give them some education. You know, half of the women that I deal with on a day-to-day basis at the women's shelter, they don't even have to take a Narcan course because they know how to Narcan, because a lot of their friends OD, their boyfriends, their friends, they know how to Narcan. And a lot of them have it on them. And what's so scary that I was told today, and I spoke about it last week, they mixing horse tranquilizer with the opiates or with the fentanyl. And when you mix that with that, Narcan can't save you. And I asked the woman today, because I seen her, and she said it's ketamine, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. When you mix ketamine with fentanyl, there's no Narcan that's going to save you.
Yeah, it's a new problem, it is creating an issue.
Imagine that. Listen, and I'm going to speak to your question, Dr. Alfonso, about, me bringing up the politicians. And all the politicians that I've had I've had the opportunity to speak to, my suggestion was that they're getting the information from the wrong places. Right? And I'm piggybacking off of my brother, because at the end of the day, treatment, old school treatment worked. We're talking about a population of people that could tell you that it's ketamine. We're talking about a population of people that did not have to have a Narcan course. If you stop and talk to some of the individuals that are out there, they're some of the most intelligent, creative, smartest people that you ever want to lay your eyes on. And what we're doing right now is a hindrance to who they are. We're treating them as if they don't have the ability to do better. When we continue to enable them, treatment, old school treatment works. Old school treatment works. Consequences. That's what got most of the people. If you ask people that are in recovery for any length of time, why do they stay in recovery? Consequences. They don't want to go back to jail. They lost their families. They can't see their children. Someone they love died. There's no consequences for the actions of the individuals that are out there on the streets. When you can openly shoot heroin or smoke crack cocaine or turn tricks in public and the police are sitting there watching, there's a real problem in our society. We're treating a population of people that a chemist. I've talked to quite a few of people because I've worked in homeless shelters. I've worked in dual diagnoses. I've worked in domestic violence shelters. You got doctors and lawyers out there. You have school teachers. You have educated individuals out there. Something happened, and we're not addressing the underlying issues. Old school treatment worked because it forced you to address the underlying issues. Those reasons that kept me using and slowly killing myself, those things that kept me going back and forth to jail, old school treatment forced me to look at those issues and address them, which allowed me to build the foundation for which I now stand on. 31 years later, I could walk through Mass and Cass and never think about joining the party. I don't miss what drugs and or alcohol did to my life. But there's trauma on top of trauma down there. And there's no solution because there's no consequences. We need people with lived experience. We need people that have been in the trenches. We need people like that in those facilities, guiding them. Someone comes to me and says, I want to get high. I haven't used in 5 days, but I want to get high. The first question I'm going to ask them is why? What do you miss? Why do you want to go back to doing that? The way we're treating addiction now is they're going, well, let me give you this prescription to counteract that. You're giving people opioids for an opioid and expecting them not to crave an opioid. That's baffling to me. You're giving people opioids to treat an opioid addiction and then telling them not to want to continue to use opioids. But again, we're treating people that have the ability to run the world as if they can't tie their own shoes. We have to tie them for them. Because they don't feel like bending over.
Again, I think excellent points. And I think we're going to stop here. I want to thank my guests, as usual, for a spirited discussion. And I, you know, I want to ask, as we go through the week and we're going to prepare, unfortunately, we didn't get to talk about when some really what we would call high-profile individuals suffer from unfortunate consequences associated with drug overdose or addiction, such as the artist formerly known as Prince, or I guess he was known as Prince at the time he left, and Michael Jackson, and the gentleman who played Omar in The Wire, also unfortunate. And, you know, to be honest with you, when these events occurred, I thought that they were going to have a tremendous impact on how we approach things, especially in the BIPOC community, but it doesn't seem like a lot has translated into. So for my esteemed guests, I want the next time we speak, we're going to talk about that a little bit and your thoughts. And also, Lael, again, tremendous points. Brother Rob, tremendous points. And Sister Melinda, who was on earlier, tremendous points. And if I had to put everything in perspective, I feel strongly motivated to try to see if we can do something. I think at minimum, maybe we should try to get somebody who's actually on the other side of this. This is a person who's not in recovery and in the struggle on this podcast so that we can talk about some of these issues and try to come up with solutions. I've treated patients who are down on Mass and Cast. I've seen them. For me, it's an incredibly challenging experience to help folks with because, as you said, Cicely, the ones that are down there, there's something else that's going on that's attracting them. And to see this and what it represents is very tough. You know, we could go on with a lot of this for a very long time. And I thank you guys again for sharing it. And for our audience and for those people who hear out there, the BASE initiative was started in Massachusetts to try to increase the number of counselors of color to do addiction-based work in the communities. And we're all graduates of BASE, and we're very thankful for that opportunity. And one of the goals of the podcast is to try to change the perspective and also to provide the amazing intellectual insight that my colleagues on the panel have to the community to really try to discuss these issues and come up with solutions, as well as educate the public on what's really going on here. So each week, we'll try to keep the topics fresh, exciting, and relevant to what is going on, because that's part of why we train. So I want to thank my esteemed guests, again, Sister Lael Morris and Robert Conley and Sister Melinda Perrin. We will be back next week with our panel. And Sister Lael, Brother Robert, before we close out, I'll let you guys close out with everything. Just feel free. The floor is yours. And then we will come back next week when we will talk about the other issues I've mentioned, well, solutions, and then what happens when overdose addiction occurs in high-profile individuals. Does anything
just want to say thank you, Dr. Alfonso Brown. Giving us the platform, for coming up with this platform. Like, it was a genius idea. We appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Sister. Yeah. No problem. We're a team, and together, everyone does well, so we thank you.
My sentiments goes out to giving glory to the Most High God and to everybody's understanding. And I would just like to say to Brother Alfonso, it's been a blessing meeting you in BASE and continuing the relationship outside of BASE, the school program. And it has been a blessing, and it has changed my life and look at things a lot different. And only if we can help one person, we have done our job. Okay. It's just, you know, getting off work, doing doubles, you being on call. And like we spoke yesterday, what one lion knows in the jungle, every lion knows. So pretty soon, Lael's going to be a producer. I'm going to be a producer. Sister Melinda's going to be a producer. And if we can create producers, then we're creating people that produce, that's productive in life. And it may be a challenge with me with computer skills, Lael with computer skills, and I don't know her deficiencies. But what I'm saying is each one teach one, from the root to the fruit. And I just appreciate this forum, and thank y'all. And our audience.
Oh, That's right. And thank you, audience, because without you guys and your support, wouldn't be here. But I want to tell you, I've been blessed to work with a king and a queen, two queens today, I guess. And they carry themselves in that way and operate in that way. And you know, at the heart of this, we're all servants, and we see that as our work. And like you said, Brother Rob, Sister Liel, you know, glory be to God for what he continues Amen. To create. And we will be having a production from each member of the cast, so please join in. We will be rotating that option, and folks will bring, because everyone here has a very unique and interesting perspective of many, many years in the field and a lot of frontline experience. So I think it is important and imperative that we enable each of our cast members to contribute to the fullest, to the full experience, so that the audience, you guys, can enjoy the full total of that. So I want to thank everybody again for joining us today, and we will be here again.